What happened at Chernobyl? I think a lot of people have seen the show, a lot of interest for that. But why am I here tonight? Why am I giving this presentation? So I am a nuclear engineer, and I became a nuclear engineer because I'm passionate about climate change. I'm passionate that nuclear power is one of the most powerful tools we have to fight climate change. And Chernobyl in that context is really difficult. It was the worst nuclear disaster that's ever happened. And so I'm here tonight because I believe that one of the problems nuclear power has is a lack of trust. It's a complicated system. It has all these interconnected effects, and ultimately you have to trust that engineers, structures, and the governance of society is looking out for your interest. There's plenty of historical evidence that that's not true. If I tell you that Chernobyl can't happen again in the West, it's impossible with our reactor design, or if I tell you that there's more debate about the health effects of low doses of radiation, or that we can deal with nuclear waste, why should you believe me? Why should you trust me when there's been so much mistrust before? And so that's why I do these presentations. That's why I go out. I'm a nuclear engineer. I see myself as someone who can advocate for the nuclear industry. And I think that Chernobyl is such an important topic to understand. But the second reason I'm here is I'm a huge nerd. Chernobyl is fascinating. As a nuclear engineer in the West, you always understand, and you're always trying to understand, how far away you are from something really bad happening. Because when something bad is happening, it's really complicated and difficult to follow, difficult to model, difficult to predict. And so in the West, we've done a really good job of staying out of these really crazy regimes. And so when I first kind of flipped open a textbook and saw the Chernobyl accident, I was like, oh, that's what a prompt reactivity insertion looks like. It's not, this is bad, stay away from it, but this is what happens. And so I'm a huge nerd. I've studied Chernobyl a lot for a long time. It's a really interesting way to learn the physics, but I think it's more important for that first reason. So just to be full transparency about why I'm here. So I'm going to kind of get nerdy a little bit, and so I wanted to make sure that we understand that Chernobyl was a human tragedy. And so I'd like to take a moment of silence before we begin, because as with so many tragedies, the people who are most impacted had the least ability to prevent it. The people in Pripyat, the people surrounding Ukraine, the reactor operators even, really had no way to prevent what was going to happen that night. There were 31 prompt fatalities from Chernobyl, hundreds of cleanup workers who had no understanding of the radiation effects that could happen to them, hundreds and thousands of people who were exposed to radiation without their consent. So 1966, 17 years before Chernobyl exploded, as part of a 10-year plan, the Soviet Union decided to add 12 gigawatts of nuclear power into the grid. Nuclear power was seen as an important, prestigious symbol, in addition to the coal and the oil that they had, and also as part of their weapons development program. A nuclear power station was plopped on a map, given its centrality in the grid, near a small town of Kolpachi. The town of Pripyat, many people are familiar with, was really the workers' village that was designed to house the construction and operations crews. When they were thinking about building the reactor, they actually did a trade study on multiple different reactor types that were available. So there was the RBMK, but there was also the pressurized water reactor that the West was building, as well as a gas-cooled reactor that had started to have experimental work. But they selected the RBMK. RBMK 1000 is the name of the reactor that was built. And if you read the Soviet report, they have this interesting acknowledgment. They say, while the engineering factors were the worst, the availability of supply and the ease of construction were why it was selected. So they built this plant there, and they called it Chernobyl. So RBMK was not a dumb design by any means. It's actually sort of beautiful in one sense in the way and the trades that had to be made in its design. So it's huge. For the reactor of the day, when it was built, it was the largest, most powerful reactor constructed. Reactors being built in the United States at the time were a third of this size. It was cheap and simple to build. So it was not simple to operate, and I'll talk about that in a second. But all of the components, and we're actually going to get a pretty good understanding of what's going on in that plant if you follow with me through the end of this. It was pipes. It was graphite blocks. It was small components. There was no huge steel welded vessels, no large diameter welding. This was easy to build for local tradesmen in the Soviet Union. It also used very low enrichment fuel. The Soviet Union didn't have the enrichment capacity, the industrial base that the United States had at the time. So they were able to use very low enriched fuel in this reactor design. It had continuous refueling. So rather than in the US, plants shut down every 18 months to refuel, but this plant could run continuously refueling. Now, those last three points actually have a very important tie together. So this reactor produced high quality weapons grade plutonium. And yeah, that was a design feature. And actually, if you look at this design, the US also had water-cooled graphite-moderated reactors. They operated at very low power, and they only produced weapons-grade plutonium. These produced commercial power and just the purest. So what were the problems? You know, the biggest problem, and we're going to talk about this a lot, is positive void reactivity. And that goes, that's inherent in a graphite-moderated reactor. If I do my job, you will understand what that sentence means by the end of this. It had complex and non-intuitive nuclear physics. Fine. But even to nuclear engineers that I know, looking at what's going on here requires really careful understanding of a lot of physics that aren't intuitive. Codes that were in place at the time could not model what was going on in Chernobyl. And they knew this. And that's, you know, they thought they understood it well enough. But it was definitely hard to operate. At power, there are 1,650 individual reactors, in a lot of ways, going on inside there. And it was huge. And the size of the core doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to you, but it doesn't make a lot of sense if you don't think about neutron physics. But a core this large, this is a PWR core, the blue cylinder in the center. This is what a light water reactor in the West looks like. So compared to that, you can have multiple cores. The neutrons are so far apart they can't talk to each other. So you can have power in one part of the core and be shut down in another part of the core. So let's understand how an RBMK works and, you know, kind of a generic nuclear reactor in general. So let's start with the pump. So pump circulates water. It goes through a main distribution header and then up through the fuel. Next to the fuel, it boils and turns into steam. Every fuel tube has its own steam header. We're going to see on the next slide how many fuel tubes those actually are. This is a very simplified schematic. Those steam tubes go into a steam drum, steam separator, where the steam goes to a turbine, and the so there's water droplets in the steam, and so the water droplets go back to the coolant pump. But the steam goes to a turbine. It expands and cools. That produces electricity, which goes off to the grid. Then the pump, the water that pumps back goes to the pump. If you think that animation was cool, I've had a lot of flights recently. Just wait. So this is, first of all, this picture is only available on Pinterest. I have no idea why. I trolled every page of Google looking RBMK, RBMK 1000, Chernobyl, and this was like on page 43 on Pinterest. I have no idea why. Anyway. Awesome picture. So this is a 3D piping diagram of an RBMK. So in the center, you have the core. Every one of those gray lines contains fuel and coolant. And also, you know, we're not going to go into it because it's not really germane, but at the top is where the refueling machine connects. So you can individually, at power, pull a fuel bundle out, put in a new one. So after you generate steam, those steam lines, every single one of those steam lines comes from its own fuel tube, going into four moisture separators. From the moisture separators, goes to the turbine, which is offside. There's a turbine on each side of the reactor. So in that previous picture, there's one turbine. There's a left turbine and a right turbine. There's left coolant pumps, right coolant pumps drawing from the left condenser, right condenser. And from those main coolant pumps back to the inlet water, back to the core. That's the loop. I'm not really going to pause for questions because I talk a lot, and I'll leave a lot of time for questions at the end. But if I really mess something up, then throw a hand up, and I'll try and go back and cover it. So just to give you a sense, we're going to go through the physics in a second. And so I want you to have a sense of what the whole core looks like. So everyone kind of get a sense of what that picture on the left shows. So there's all these fuel tubes, each one surrounded by graphite. So I kind of blew that up just to show you what a cell looks like. So the orange is fuel. In an annulus around each fuel element, there's water. And then in an annulus around that, there's graphite. So it's fuel, water, graphite, water, fuel, water, graphite. Make sense? Cool. Okay, so decay heat. The fundamental challenge of reactor design, and I've thought about this a lot because I wanted to say that sentence. If this weren't true, we would have 100% nuclear power, and I believe that 100%. When you turn off a nuclear reactor, it does not go off. It goes to 5%. What is 5% of 3,600 megawatts? So after 1 second, 5%, that's the fuel consumption of a 747 in flight. It's about 150 megawatts, a decent-sized natural gas plant, just producing heat in the core that you thought was off. Now that goes away pretty quickly. So after a month, or sorry, after a day, it's the fuel consumption of the most powerful locomotive in the world pulling steel through the Siberian, like, tundra. That's where the most powerful locomotive in the world is. A lot of people like locomotives, a lot of internet stuff out there. And then after a month, it's the ninth most powerful locomotive. So this is heat. It's like taking that fuel and just lighting it on fire, and you have to remove that heat. So this is the fundamental challenge of reactor design. And so I have this, shutting down a reactor is not that hard generally. In the West, shutting down a reactor is assumed. Hit the scram button, shut down, right? One exception was Chernobyl. So this starts to go into the why of Chernobyl, right? I'm mostly going to talk about the what, but I want to touch on why. So Chernobyl, when it was designed, they pointed out that the design didn't have a way to deal with a loss of offsite power. And, you know, and there was some debate of how probable is it for you to lose the whole grid and also have to shut down. But they were like, this is a feature we should have. Every plant in the West has this. This is something that we should do. So there's one sentence in the original operating procedure that says, on a loss of offsite power, use the steam still in the generator to spin the turbine, make electricity for the pumps, period. That was it. And they knew that they had this gap. Now, there is some debate, and in the show Chernobyl, they talk about this very differently. This is, I'll come back to this at the end. But from all the literature I can tell, certainly never at Chernobyl, and almost certainly never at any other RBMK had this test been successfully run. They had tried this three times, and they were coming up to the fourth attempt. Analog electronics is apparently really hard. I'm in mechanical engineering. So T-minus 4 years, 4 years before the accident. Another RBMK, Ignalina 1, ruptures a fuel rod. And they blame it on operator error. But operator error, and then the commission recommends a whole host of design changes to the control rods of RBMKs. So again, there was some operator error, but we need to redesign all the control rods. Except none of those changes were implemented, not one. It was a commission report. It wasn't even circulated to other reactor operators. Amazingly, 1.5 years later, sorry, 1.5 years before the accident, not later, a similar event happened at Chernobyl. Didn't rupture a fuel rod. They were doing a routine shutdown. They hit the scram button, and they saw a slight power increase. Couldn't explain it. And that was it. Couldn't explain it, moved on. So let's go back to the basics. We're going to build up from here. So what is fission? A uranium atom is heavy. If it gets hit by a neutron, it splits. It releases fission products, and on average, 2.3 neutrons. So sometimes 10, sometimes 2, 2.3 on average. The fission products are actually what produce the heat. So it's these heavy isotopes slowing down, hitting other things, produces heat. And excess neutrons keep the chain reaction going. So this is sort of a similar chart a lot of people have seen before. One neutron comes in, hits uranium atom, two neutrons fly out, hits another uranium atom, two neutrons from that, boom, boom, boom. So that time period is about 0.0001 seconds fast. At a reactor period of 0.0001 seconds, that doubling time, if you have a slight increase in reactivity and you start doubling at that rate, you will increase power by 2,000,000% in 1 second. Oh, I screwed up my transitions. But so critical means increasing, or sorry, supercritical means increasing. So this is supercritical here. Critical is stable. Subcritical means decreasing. So obviously you can't run a reactor with a period of 0.0001 seconds. Anytime you had any reactivity increase, it would be bad. So what happens is you trust that some of your neutrons aren't going to hit anything. Some of your neutrons are going to get absorbed somewhere. Some of your neutrons are going to get lost. And so you'll kind of get this 1-1-1 thing going. Okay, nice and stable. But then if one neutron hit something, you'd have that whole chain reaction running away. So you rely on something called delayed neutrons. I may have spoken through that a little fast. How many people followed that? I'm going to do it one more time, kind of quickly, with knowing what the slides are going to click through, just because it's a little important. So supercritical. This is supercritical. One neutron's causing this chain reaction. Neutron population is increasing. Population 1, 2, 4, 8. But if you're stable, right, you're just producing constant power. Your neutron population is constant. That means most of your neutrons are flying off and not causing a chain reaction. But If one of those extra neutrons hit something, you'd go back to that chain reaction increasing. A little more sense? Okay. So when a uranium atom splits, it creates fission products. Those fission products, nuclear physics, whatever, they will release a neutron spontaneously, randomly, seconds to minutes later. And so what you do is you get your chain reaction almost constant, and then you have 0.64% of your neutron population coming from those spontaneously released neutrons. But they're very predictably, not spontaneous, they're very predictably released. They're just a distribution of the time. So you get this lag. You're almost critical, and then this old neutron comes in, and now you're critical again. You're almost critical, old neutron comes in. You're just bouncing along, and you get this lag, because if your power goes up, you're only getting delayed neutrons from the power you used to be producing. So this is how you operate a reactor, by keeping the population critical and relying on delayed neutrons. So reactivity, we're going to talk about this a lot. So reactivity is a change in your multiplication factor. So a 1 to 2 population, multiplication factor of 2, your population doubled. I promise it gets more exciting. I just want you guys to have some understanding what I'm talking about later. So a positive reactivity, your neutron population is increasing. Let's say you had a control rod in the core, it was absorbing neutrons, you took it out. That's a positive reactivity. You're going towards supercritical. And then something happens. Your control rod goes in. Your leakage increases. Something happens. That's a negative reactivity. You go towards subcritical. So these things can cancel out. You stay critical. You have some factors that are positive reactivity, some that are negative. They're balanced, harmony. But if you lose one of your negative reactivities, now you still have the positive reactivity. That might be your fuel, it might be whatever. So you lose a negative reactivity, you still have the positive reactivity in the core. Balance is critical. This was a pun that I made unintentionally, and it made me really happy. Okay, so there's 5 reactivity effects that we're going to talk about. Control rods, coolant voids, xenon, and a little bit less, moderation in fuel temperature. So we're going to go in depth through this slide. I'm just kidding. So I'm going to go through it really quickly, though. So this green line is the population of neutrons as energy decreases, high energy, low energy. Neutrons are born fast, but to create fission, they have to be going slow. So they have to slow down. The orange is uranium-238. Uranium-238 is not fissile. It doesn't produce energy when it captures a neutron. Uranium-235 is. So when we talk about enriched uranium, it's how much 235 do you have, the blue line. So, and the important point, if you can sort of capture that, there's going to be a better slide, the next slide, is that as the temperature of uranium-238 goes up, I'm not going to explain why, but I would love to afterward, these bands expand, they get wider, and so you're capturing more neutrons. And so as a neutron's trying to slow down, it has to go through this valley of fission resonances, the fission resonance of death. A lot, people make really like weird jokes about this. And those expand, and those will capture your neutrons. And so the hotter your fuel gets, the more you're stealing neutrons in that resonance region. So there's a negative thermal feedback from your fuel temperature. The hotter your fuel is, the less power you're producing. That's a good one, right? Nice and stable. Also, there's other things in here that are moderators. They're helping you slow this down. The neutrons are bouncing off of water atoms, carbon atoms, slowing down, slowing down. If they get captured while they're trying to slow down, then they die. Okay. Let's go less complicated. A whole bunch of different things. So for the orange and the green, the y-axis is cross-section. So it's the probability of an interaction. And for the green, it's population. So neutrons normalized to the total neutron flux, how many neutrons are in any energy group. It is log scale. Okay. So emoji slide. So we're going to, same content as the last slide. Hopefully a little easier to follow. So neutrons are born fast. And they hit stuff. They bounce around, they slow down. Bounce around, and eventually, if they avoid getting captured by water, if they escape the uranium resonances, and they miss the control rods, they'll get old and slow, they'll have a party, they'll make baby new neutrons, and they can fly off, have a happy life. This is somewhere over Wisconsin. Okay, so this is what the RBMK control rods look like. So this is this middle picture, control rods fully inserted. Boron is a very strong neutron poison. If you have boron in your core, it's absorbing a ton of neutrons. Graphite is a moderator. Graphite's one of those things that helps slow you down. Most of the time, the core has a lot of graphite in it. That's what's slowing the neutrons down. In an RBMK, almost all of your moderation occurs in graphite. The control rods will absorb heat when they're absorbing neutrons. Neutrons have some power, and so you need to cool them down. So in the RBMK, the control rods are in water tubes. Okay? Water in the RBMK is a neutron poison. In a PWR, in a Western reactor, and there's Russian PWRs, but a Western reactor of the time, water was the only moderator. So all the moderation happened in the water and all the poisoning. Moderation was weaker than the poisoning. So in a PWR, water is basically a moderator. But here's graphite. Okay, so what happened? You know, we talk about graphite tips if you've seen the show. This is what the control would actually look like. It's roughly to scale. So there's this graphite tip in the core. And it's not crazy that this is there because water is a poison. If you replace a poison with another poison, like a stronger poison, right? You're only getting that little delta in reactivity. You had poison, you put a stronger poison, little delta. On the other hand, if you have graphite, the moderator, you're replacing a moderator with a poison. You're replacing a positive reactivity with a negative reactivity. So it's a much more effective control rod. You get much more worth is the term we use. So I'm gonna come back to this later, but this is what the post Chernobyl control rod modifications look like. This is also the post Ignalina design recommendation. But so anyway, active core, here's the fuel. This is where the critical region is, but general idea, control rods absorb neutrons, a little bit about the RBMK. We're gonna come back to it, explain it more later. Or right here. So we're gonna talk about positive reactivity later, but this is what was going on. This is the bottom of the core. When the graphite tip moved down, there's water in the bottom of the core. It's like a little reactor down there, right? It's this huge core. This bottom can be critical just by itself. And so you're displacing water with graphite in the bottom of the core first. At the top, you got these two negative, right? So this is as you insert from left to right. So negative, negative, nice. The top of your reactor is shutting down. Bottom gets this little spike, right? You took water out, replaced it with graphite. So what did water do in the RBMK? So slower neutrons lead to more fissions. The slower your neutrons are, the more fission you have. So captured neutrons lead to less fission. This is poisoning, what poisoning means. Water can be an absorber or a moderator. Water can slow you down or it can be a poison, and the net effect can be either one. So this is kind of that unit cell before you have a neutron being born here. It goes through some water, doesn't get captured. It slows down as it bounces around the graphite, makes it through the water, hits another fuel rod, chain reaction. On the other hand, if it didn't have such a lucky life, born in the fuel rod, and it died in the water. So, coolant reactivity, void reactivity. This is a good one too. Okay, so you have fuel in the core, and you have water coming in, right? The neutron being born here makes it to the water, it dies. I removed the graphite, just simplify this drawing. So now you start coming up in power. Your fuel's making more heat. Now your water is going to start to boil. And so as the water boils, you have water in the bottom, steam at the top. Steam is less dense than water by about 1,000 times. So where you used to have water that was blocking a neutron, now you have steam, not blocking the neutrons, flies right through, hits the graphite, bounces around, because graphite doesn't boil, lands on the other side and has its, makes more neutrons. So this is called the void reactivity. If you boil, you produce heat, you make more steam, your fuel gets a little hotter, but you also lose all the absorption in the water. And in the RBMK, there's so much absorption in the water that it just totally dominates the fuel. So this is how it's supposed to work. If you have a reactor transient, when they designed it, they knew about this. They didn't realize how strong it was, and they didn't realize how strong it could be in different operating modes. But they knew about positive void reactivity. So if something happens to increase power, there's increased boiling. If you were sitting at power, there's decrease in xenon. We'll talk about xenon in a second. Your fuel gets hotter, that's a negative reactivity. Your control rods move, negative reactivity, and you hit a new equilibrium, and you're good. So 24 hours before the accident. Scheduled to be offline the next day, and they say, all right, we have a shutdown tomorrow, we're gonna run this test. We only shut down very infrequently because we have online refueling. We need to run this test tomorrow. This is their window. Now, we talk about decay power. This is a decay power test. It's supposed to run from full power. They don't know when they're going to lose power to the grid. But the more power you're sitting at, the worse your decay power is. That first second's really hot, time after that. So they wanted to go as low power as possible. But The way this is supposed to work is they have excess steam, right? They have excess steam in the boiler, and that's what's allowing them to spin the turbine and power the pumps. So if they're too low power, there's not enough steam to power the pumps. So they can't be too low. So they needed to be between about 700 and 1,000 megawatts. That was what they showed. So test procedure, what was supposed to happen, close the right size turbine valve, excess steam in the turbine used to power the pumps, and as the steam ran down, the generators would turn on. Oh, sorry, that's messed up. As the steam ran down, the pumps would increase flow rate through, or they would keep flowing water through the core, and meanwhile, someone would go turn on the diesels. The diesels took a long time to turn on. So, and when they ran the test, they knew this was a test, so they left the left side coolant pumps on full blast. Plenty of cooling water, not supposed to be a big issue. Oops. So 11 hours beforehand, they've been sitting down in power for a little bit. They get a call from grid operator saying, hey, don't go down in power. Side note, this is like a really interesting thing for me about how grids run. So today in the US still, if a nuclear power plant has to change power, there's a phone call. The grid operator calls them and says, like, hey, you can't go down in power. It's like no digital control. And it was the same back then. So they said, and actually there's some little interesting tidbit that it was May Day the next day, and so there was end of month production quotas that had to be met. So people were working overtime. That's why they couldn't reduce power, at least according to one random internet article I read. So they say, okay, power is held steady at 1,600 megawatts. I think I mentioned this before, but they had turned the emergency cooling system off to prepare for this test, and they left it off. And maybe I didn't say that, but that really goes to something I'm going to talk about later, which is a safety culture going on in the Soviet nuclear industry at the time. Now, that had no impact on the test. The emergency cooling system would have done nothing. But it's the concept that, hey, I'm going to run my reactor for 11 hours at power on the grid. Anything could happen with the emergency cooling system, like unplugged, physically unplugged. Oh, so as they come down in power and they're sitting there and they wait and they wait, xenon is accumulating. So what's xenon? So when uranium fissions, instantly it creates a lot of things. One of them is one of the isotopes it creates is iodine. Iodine's fine. It's actually like a personally toxic, right? Iodine's a chemical and a radiation hazard, but it doesn't affect reactor power. But xenon does. So over 6 hours, 6 hour half-life, iodine decays to xenon. And over 9 hours, that xenon will just go away by itself. But instantly, xenon's a very strong neutron poison. It will absorb a lot of neutrons. And so as those neutrons flying around, they'll hit a xenon. And the xenon will turn into something else and not be xenon anymore. And so there's this balance that gets formed. You're creating xenon, and you're destroying xenon. But what's tricky is that the iodine creation, right, it was created and then it decays over 6 hours, depends on the power you used to have. And the uranium, the neutrons destroying the xenon, depends on your power now. So the amount of xenon in your core, it increases with the power you had before and decreases with the power now. So if you have a reactor and you're sitting at 50% power and you go up, you burn off xenon because you were only producing 50% worth of xenon before. Now you're burning 100% of it. Right, goes down, eventually you'll stabilize. And now if you go down in power, back to 50%, you have all of this xenon, this iodine that's building up, waiting to decay into xenon. Now your neutrons go away. That iodine's still gonna decay, doesn't care. It produces xenon peak. So in a nuclear plant in the US and in most of the world, this is like not time-scaled, well actually, but this is 3 days. So if you shut down a nuclear reactor all the way, all that iodine decays, and it's worth way more than your control rods can ever take out, and it's actually by design. And so you're shut down, plant's down for 3 days, till the xenon decays, and you can start back up. So as they're coming down to 1,600 megawatts, they're building up xenon. And as they reduce power even further to the target power, xenon accumulates even more. And so every time to get that, to get your power constant, right, if we talked about the neutron chain reaction before, so if some of your neutrons are getting hit by xenon, if they were also getting hit by control rods, your population would be decreasing. So you start pulling control rods out because the xenon's taken their place, right? The difference between xenon and control rods is that xenon can go away and not come back. So 2 hours before the test, they go down from 1,600 megawatts, and they're going down to about 700 megawatts. And so for unclear reasons, there's disagreement. There's no consistency in reports, post-accident reports. Operator error, did they fail to set the computer? Did something happen? they lost control of the reactor a little bit, and so the xenon runaway took them down to shutdown. So it went to 30 megawatts thermal, all decay power. There was no chain reaction going on in the core. And if they knew that if they sat there for long, they were never going to be able to start up because all that xenon was going to start building up. So they start quickly trying to pull control rods up, get power up, burn off that xenon. Almost all the control rods in the core are withdrawn. So, and I'm not going to talk about that. So 200 megawatts, that's where they were able to get to. They need 700 megawatts of steam to run the test. If they can only get to 200 megawatts, this test is going to fail. There is no chance of success at 200 megawatts. And they should know this. And they decide to go forward anyway. Yeah?
I thought they were told not to reduce power.
So they were told not to reduce power. Oh, maybe I skipped that slide. At 11 hours before, they said, you're good. We have enough power on the grid. You can proceed with your test. Importantly, there was a shift change. So this made a big deal. A midnight shift change. They didn't. The next day shift change did not get the operating procedure. They walked in. Here's the procedure. This is what we're running. Go do it. The other thing, too, is this was an electrical system test. It was designated an electrical system test, so only the electrical engineers had to approve it. No nuclear engineers, no reactor designers, no general design bureau. It's fully within the electrical engineering division. So almost all the control rods are withdrawn from the core. And there's a computer that was running there, an analog computer that was calculating how many control rods they need in the core for the control rods to be stronger than the water evaporating. I want to explain all that physics. It's going to be a little complicated, but there's a computer that can calculate. You need this many control rods in the core, period. That number was 15. That's the minimum you could get to. If you ever had less than 15, your reactor was highly, highly unstable. But they were manually pulling out control rods. They were not using the computer. So they got down to 8. This computer was 50 yards from the operator console, and it printed results every 15 minutes. So this wouldn't have helped them, but it was collecting the data afterward that they were able to recreate that. And they also didn't know. They had more than 8 control rods in the core. They had effectively 8 control rods. But they assumed that all 8 control rods were equal, but they're not. The control rods in the center of the core are worth a lot more. Control rods in cold part of the fuel are worth a lot more. So they had no information about that. Also, this reactor was never designed to run below 50% power. It's very, very complicated. Every one of those fuel tubes has its own coolant valve that's controlling the flow rate to each fuel tube, and those are controlled by a computer above 50% and by hand below 50%. So 20 minutes before the test. So now, they're sitting at 200 megawatts, and they're trying to come up in power anymore, but the test says, turn all the main coolant pumps on full. There is no boiling, almost no boiling going on in this reactor anymore, just a little bit at the top. So all the voids are gone, right? You're pumping in so much water, it's just going so quickly, it's cooling itself down, there's no boiling going on. So that's negative reactivity. It's pushing their power down even more. They pull out more control rods, trying to pull up power. The other thing it's doing is there's almost no void in the core. So we talked that slide before, that arrow, right, when it disappeared, that negative arrow is all of your water holding you down. Water, unlike graphite, unlike control rods, can boil. It can be gone in an instant. And that water is the only thing holding them down, that and xenon. So this reactor was now highly unstable. They're manually controlling the flow rate through the core. They're manually controlling the pump speed. Their control rods are almost all the way out of the core. Then they decide to start the test. They close the turbine. So at this point, it really doesn't matter what they would have done. From before this point, it would have been hard to shut this reactor down. They probably could have done it. They would have had to carefully, slowly reinsert control rods, keep the pumps running at full speed. Once they got enough control rods in, they could start to back off the flow rate. It would have been a delicate operation if they understood everything that was exactly going on. That didn't happen. 45 seconds before the accident, they start the test, cut the turbine power. Turbine starts spinning down, producing steam. It's producing less steam, right, because it's spinning down, and it didn't have that much steam to begin with because it was only producing 200 megawatts. So pumps coast down. This leads to increased boiling. Now their power starts to go up, actually, right? They're losing coolant in the core. So the xenon that they'd accumulated starts to burn away. Now, again, the fuel used to be hot, and they used to have control rods that used to lead to a new equilibrium. Fuel's cold. There are no control rods, no equilibrium. Instead, the power keeps increasing. That leads to more boiling. Now they're in a positive feedback loop. So the power starts to rise. They see this in the monitors and they go, that's weird. we're shutting down the reactor. Why is the power going up? So they hit the scram button. They think this is the button. And there's actually, you know, part of the thought is they thought that button was fail safe. They thought that button, that's our get out of jail free card. Whatever we're doing to the reactor, hit the button, we go home. So it drops all the control rods. But those water cooling channels that the control rod's in are actually pretty tight around the control rod. So it's like a piston you're compressing. So these, and the reactor is huge. So those two effects mean these control rods take forever to get down in the core. 18 seconds. They wait. After 6 seconds, there's a shock. Control rods stop moving. So what happened? That positive reactivity in the bottom of the core started boiling as the control rods got to the bottom of the core about 6 seconds in. That inserted a small positive reactivity on an already positive feedback loop. So control rods start to go in the core, displacing water in the bottom. This causes fuel. This was localized. This wasn't everywhere in the core. There was very different coolant channels going through the core, but a few of them had a little bit lower flow rate. So the fuel started to get hotter. This fuel is getting really hot. So this is a picture of a fuel failure test done at INL, different fuel, Idaho National Lab in the US, different fuel, different values. But full power for the RBMK was about 190 cal per gram. Right now, those fuel rods are about 600 cal per gram. So it is dust. It is glowing dust. It disintegrates. There's a cladding, zirconium cladding, that separates the fuel from the water. Gone. Vaporized. Now the fuel's direct contact with the steam. What happens if you put glowing plasma sand into water? Flashes to steam. Control. So this coolant channel was all full of water. Now it's all full of steam. Instantly. Overpressures the tube. The tube ruptures. So I described what's about to happen to a senior design engineer. And I said, they knew that this would happen. They thought that welds could fail at the bottom of the fuel, and the steam would flash, and it would fail the tube. And so they've designed this cavity to be safe if two fuel channels fail, because like one's unlikely. And so what are the odds of two? He looks at me. He goes, brave. So this happens in about five fuel channels, three to four, at least five. So the fuel tube ruptures, very, very high pressure. All that steam escapes into the cavity space. Now what's holding it in? A 2,000-ton welded steel lid that every control rod and every fuel channel goes through. They knew when they designed the RBMK that if more than two fuel channels failed, the pressure increase would be enough to separate the upper shield and pull out all the control rods. That's what he said was brave. And that's what's about to happen. So the steam pressure increases inside the core. It lifts the 2,000-ton lid and all of the control rods up into the air. That actually wasn't that bad. Because the control rods, I'm serious. Like the control rods were already out. So lifting all the control rods out of the core didn't do much of anything. But what it did do was all of the remaining 1,630 fuel channels that hadn't flashed to steam were now exposed to atmospheric pressure. They're running about 7 megapascals. And so as soon as that lid lifted, every one of those fuel channels flashed to steam. It's like you use a pressure cooker. As you open it, all that water in there turns to steam as it depressurizes. So now all of them are open to the atmosphere at the top. They all flash to steam. Positive void feedback, like so fast. So there's a number, $1. That's the amount of delayed neutrons in the core at any time. If you insert $1, you are prompt critical. You are increasing power at a period of 0.0001 seconds. $5 of reactivity is the estimate of what flashing all of the water instantly in the core was. This wasn't a nuclear bomb. It was not. If you tell a nuclear engineer it was a nuclear explosion, they get really, really upset. But it's like, hey, this was an explosion caused by nuclear things. Forgive the semantics. So then what happened? All this fuel is now producing 5-600 cal per gram. And now you have air in there. Water and zirconium, the alloy that used to clad the fuel, at very, very high temperature produced hydrogen. This is actually what happened in Fukushima. It's unfortunate. Zirconium is far and away the best metal you can use in a reactor core because it's transparent to neutrons from that perspective. They are looking at other alloys to use. But everything else absorbs neutrons. Zirconium is almost completely transparent to neutrons, and so it's not a poison. It's everywhere in your core, so if it was even a little bit of a poison, it would make your reactor really inefficient. But this problem, very, very, very hot fuel, water instantly flashing to steam, reacting with the zircaloy produces hydrogen. Hydrogen, a lot of heat and a lot of oxygen. This is what Chernobyl looked like after the explosion. 2,000-ton lid was thrown up in the air and landed back down. Almost the entire rest of the core was ejected. Most of it stayed within the building. Plenty of it left through the plume. This is kind of the end of the cool physics. From here on, there was an open pit fire in the reactor, burning graphite, burning fuel, sending radionuclides into the environment. So why did Chernobyl happen? I think if you followed along and I did a good enough job, you now understand what happened, but why? Why was this allowed to happen? Why did engineers design something that this could go wrong? And how do we know this can't happen in the West? And even more importantly, we're designing complex engineered systems that go wrong when they fail. 737 is a really good example of that. There's a lot of parallels. It was designed in stages over time by multiple different design groups who didn't know each other. It was modified over time by people who didn't know the original designers. And it was complicated. It's impossible, it's almost impossible to really regulate something like that in a system where the designer regulates him or herself. So why did it happen? I don't know. What I know is that this requires human nature will make things like this happen if you don't put systems in place to prevent it. If you just let people be lazy, and if you let people be calm and comfortable, things like this will happen. The Soviet Union also had a very authoritarian government where people couldn't express safety concerns. But things like this have happened in the West. Challenger explosion, 737 comes to mind. And so why did Chernobyl happen? Chernobyl happened because of a lack of good engineering process. And we can't just trust that a good engineering process will happen. We have to make it happen. We have to be vocal about it. And we have to look for our failures and examine ourselves. The nuclear industry that I'm a part of today has learned a lot from these lessons and is one of the most like rigorously regulated industries in the world today. And that's really difficult being in the industry. But it's sort of hard when you see something like this to not say, hey, that's kind of a good thing. But the other thing you can do is not design systems that are unstable. Not design systems that get to the point where you don't quite understand the physics. They knew their codes couldn't predict what was going on here. They had very simple reactor codes at the time. They knew they were making something unstable. There's always a drive for money. There's always a drive for authoritarians to say, we need to do something. So it's not like a really rosy picture. I mean, Chernobyl was bad. I think, obviously, we've learned a lot. We continue to do better. The US has put a really rigorous nuclear regulatory program in place and had one at the time. But I think it's important as a nuclear engineer to be upfront about the failures that happen and make sure that we don't recreate those mistakes. And that's why I go and do these talks because, this is something that we are very concerned about and something we design safer, better technology to avoid these even happening. New reactors have new features that prevent this stuff from being possible, and to not kind of go off on a long tangent, that's sort of why I'm more confident about nuclear power going forward. RBMK shouldn't have been built, but we need nuclear power to fight climate change. Maybe a weird conclusion, but that's sort of the reality we live with. So ever since I've been a nuclear engineer and Chernobyl comes out, I get this question all the time, was the show accurate? I know a lot of nuclear engineers who don't think the show was accurate. And I sort of take a little issue with that because it's an accurate portrayal of a lot of things that happened and a lot of ways that characters probably talked. So there's a scene where the chief engineer, who has his name I'm forgetting, you know, he's talking to Gorbachev and saying, was it Gorbachev? Khrushchev. He's talking to Khrushchev and saying, like, He's talking to Gorbachev and he's describing radiation as bullets. Now, if I were to describe radiation health physics to you, I would use a slightly more nuanced analogy. But if I gave the analogy and the description and the level of risk that I would describe to you right now to someone saying there's nothing we need to do about an open pit reactor burning, he might not do anything. And so it's like fair in the moment that he exaggerates, right? And it's just tough as a nuclear engineer watching to know, I don't know when they're exaggerating for effect because that's what the characters would have said. And I know that people watching it can't tell the difference between they're exaggerating for effect and they're exaggerating because that's reality because he's a scientist standing up and talking. So I highly recommend as an NPR podcast if you've seen the show and have like detailed step-by-step questions. The broad sequence of event is accurate. There's lots and lots of true, very specific details and quotes. Radiation is portrayed accurate to the moment. And what I mean by that is people were afraid and people didn't know what was going on. And radiation is scary. And so the fear that they portray capture that. It doesn't, I wouldn't say, is not a radiation health physics class. Like the baby, so there's a baby that gets radiation poisoning, and like it's really counter to how radiation physics works. But I don't want to kind of like go through that point by point now. It's just something to kind of look into. There's some dramatization. And it's also hard to tell when characters were lying. Like, so the guy says, like, I was lying in the presentation, because he had to lie. Right? So when he points at Dyatlov and says it was a routine test, it was not a routine test, never been done successfully before. Is that the show making a mistake? Is that him lying? Or is that an inaccuracy? I don't know, and you as a viewer don't know. And that's sort of why it's difficult. Okay, so I know that was a lot. I tried to go through everything. Actually, before I take questions, because I did go quickly, I have some cool pictures of RBMKs that like didn't really fit in here. So this is the top of an RBMK that was operating until 2013. And so each one of these is the top of a fuel tube, except for these boxes are the control rods. And so that just kind of gives you an idea of what's going on. This is like well above the upper shield of the reactor. Yeah, and so this is each one. So these are, so RBMKs are still running. There's about 13 still running. They're the three other units, so Chernobyl 1, 2, and 3 ran until 2005 through 2010. So 2003, or Unit 3 shared a wall with Chernobyl Unit 4 and kept operating until 2005. For power, provide power to Ukraine. And that's, I mean, because of the cleanup, you know, the radiation from the core, once they did that initial cleanup, like workers wearing booties and things walking through it, it's like the radiation that's left is if you drink it, eat it, that is where you can start to have a health effect. But, you know, coming into the town and working, it's pretty low relative to the dose you get working in a plant, which is already low. So this is what the bottom of a reactor looked like. So all those individual tubes coming up. And you see these are like small diameter tubes. The tubes in it, or the pipes in a normal reactor are like 16, 18 inches, require very special welding. 2-inch tubes can be welded by, you know, a much less trained mechanic. And so this is something I didn't really talk about, but the fuel handling machine, this is a schematic of how that works. So it comes down and latches with a fuel tube in operation while the reactor is running at full power, removes this nut, pulls out this plug, sets it aside, pulls the fuel rod out, sets it aside. While it's pressurized with 7 megapascals of water, puts another tube in, screws the cap back on, goes on to the next one. There's this huge crane I'll come back to in a second. These slides are meh. This is an actual picture of the control rods. This is a control rod diagram. So it's just showing, this is the post Chernobyl modification. So I didn't talk about that, but after Chernobyl, this picture, where is it? No. This one, yeah. So this is the control rod fully withdrawn. And so they extended this telescope by 1.25 meters so that when the control rod was fully withdrawn, the graphite was at the bottom of the core. So you only got a negative reactivity insertion. That was it. They knew that at Ignalina 1, that was a design recommendation. And changing a few other things, which they didn't change. And so this is just showing you these control rods are in the core in this red line. So this is the upper shield plate. This is what came off. This is a graphite blocks you were seeing on that previous picture. This is the core, and this is the biological shield. This was above ground, so like the control room was, so the turbine hall was over here. I think the control room was like, it wasn't that far away. It was just a ton of concrete in the way. This is a full plant schematic I found. I was like, wow, that's really nice. This is from one of the operating reactors. It's not Chernobyl. So this is the turbine hall. These are the left and right coolant pumps, separators. And so these are the pumps that they shut off while these were supplying excess power to the core. I took that slide out. I thought I'd have fewer slides. So, yeah, questions.